Kaya FM Podcast.
Law Reports with Michael Motsoeneng Bill on Kaya FM 95.9.
Good evening to you and welcome to the Law Report. It's an open line. It's your show. Give us a call, 086-000-0959. And you design the show. Anything you want to talk about, anything under the sun.
The Law Report with Michael Motsoeneng Bill on Kaya FM 95.9.
We're tag teaming this. I'm with Nobizita Mlilo.
That's a name of royalty. That's a name of royalty.
Indeed. Are you good?
Always good, Mike. Always
Are you
good.
Ready?
I've always as ready as I can be.
All right. If you have any questions for either Nobizita or myself, you've got an attorney, myself, an advocate, Nobizita. And we're happy to deal with any question that you have. And what I wanted to pick up on, I know you're very passionate about the state capture. So maybe we'll pick up on that and, you know, you'll share some of your views. But if you, like me, have some things that you want to find out from Nobizita or even from me, do give us a call, 086-000-0959. You can also send us a text message, 36959. All right. So, I mean, we all have our views about the state capture. And before, you know, we start getting calls, offline you and I have spoken about this. Let's make public your views.
Yeah. I speak without prejudice. Mike, you know, I think that the essence of state capture, well, the concept of state capture in and of itself, I think is problematic right from the onset, from a definitional point of view. But be that as it may, I started having uneasiness about the state capture process right from the judgment of the North Gauteng High Court in respect of who had the powers to appoint the chairperson of the commission. And I say this with the greatest respect to the judges there. I found the judgment very weird then, and I think we even discussed it. Fast forward to the actual progress of the state capture commission itself.
Wait, you can't just say something is weird and move on. What do you mean?
No, but look, I mean the law was patently clear about
the power of establishing a commission.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And who had the power to appoint for instance the chairperson of the commission one. Yeah. And for whatever reason, reasons that are stated in that judgment, in my view, are extremely unconvincing, and they're at odds with the law.
Yeah.
And I still maintain that that judgment was patently wrong.
Yeah.
That it can be done to satisfy a political environment that existed at the time. Whatever views anyone might have, the point is, it is only the state president who can appoint the chairperson of a commission of inquiry,
and not an instruction.
Yeah. And I think the fault line started there.
Yeah.
And anything else that may or may not have happened in the commission, which invites legitimate differences about of opinion about whether or not that commission is what it says to be,
yeah,
has its genesis in that decision.
Yeah, you're right. As we did touch on this, and as you were speaking, I got reminded of some of the views that I had, which I guess it was layered, the problems, right? The first problem is establishing a commission is a power that is vested with the president,
yeah,
right? And then a public protector then says, hang on, I want you to start a commission, but goes further and say, but I want the judge to be appointed by so-and-so. So it's almost as if the public protector was dictated to the president, but also dictated to the chief justice.
Yes.
To say you must appoint you must be responsible for the appointment, which in fact did remove the discretion of the president.
Yeah.
Or the then president or the presidency. So yeah. And these are in fact constitutional powers.
Yeah.
But I think the problem is beyond that, because I think ultimately the problem is going to be big, because what this has paved the way for is that I understand that the circumstances, the mood of the country probably made way for such an event to take place. But the risk, of course, is what happens when the current public protector orders the current president to do, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And tells the Chief Justice. So the precedent that is created as a consequence of all of these various steps, is undoubtedly dangerous.
Yeah. And it has already happened in the North Gauteng High Court where there are two judgments in respect of the powers of the public protector that are clearly at odds with each other. So I think even, and with respect to the judges in the Constitutional Court, I'm still not convinced in that judgment that suggested that, because the Public Protectors Act said on the recommendation of, and the literal meaning of recommendation is exactly that. But they interpreted it to mean that the views of the public protector are binding. Perhaps.
What are you talking about? The EFF case?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the Act speaks about the decision, the public protector making recommendations. And they interpreted
it. No, but also it talks about remedial action or, what's the word? I think remedial. See, she can actually provide remedial action or dictate. So it's a little bit beyond a mere recommendation. It's, she makes findings, which in and of themselves are binding. And arising out of those findings, she then can, propose remedial action, i.e., I want you to take the following steps. The way I part, I mean, the EFF judgment is groundbreaking and I'm with it in every respect. So I don't share the criticism. How then the EFF judgment would then be used to go further than what it can is it can't go, you know, the public protector in as much as is binding and everything, it can't go and impose it. It's a constitutional duty. And I think the current public protector tried something of that nature when she tried to talk about land. I remember very vaguely when she was asking Parliament to consider, so Parliament, a different organ of state, to consider or reconsider a certain section of the Constitution, i.e. that relates to property, section 25. So the issue really starts to come to play when you start to tell me how to exercise my constitutional power. And it's different from saying, I want you to investigate how the homestead in Cairns law cost R500 million or whatever, you know, whatever amount it was. I could be exaggerating. I forget. It's like 200 million.
250 something.
A quarter of a billion rands. Yeah. Tell me how this cost you R250 million and I want you to, that's different. It's different because you're not telling somebody to exercise a constitutional power, a power which he or she exercises at their discretion. So that's sort of where I part with what's happened.
Yeah. So which is exactly why I'm saying that I think there are already contradictions already that, but if you trace it properly, those contradictions have their genesis in the judgment of the North Gauteng High Court. I wanted to take the discussion slightly further to say, then look at how the...
Sorry, let me tell the Afropolitans, if you don't call, me and this guy are going to talk. and this is not about him.
Yeah.
And it's not about me, right? It's about you. So I'd really like you to give us a call, 086-000-00959. We're literally at your disposal.
Anything they want.
You've got two lawyers.
Yeah, right? Anything at all. Yeah. Mike is very expensive, so you better get him now.
Not tonight. So cheap.
Yeah,
I'm valueless.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'll give you valuable advice for no value.
Yeah. So, they better take the chance. That billboard on the N1 needs to be paid for.
Oh, there we go again. Oh, man. 086-000-00959. Do give us a call. We want to talk to you. I want to talk to you. I miss you. Any question? Challenge us. Ask us. But I know you're thinking about, you know, that case that you had. I mean, I went to court today. Yeah. I'm going to digress a little bit. And I was waiting for my matter to be called. And there was this gentleman who was unrepresented. And it was just so, you know, I almost wanted to say, okay, Lala Pants, let me do it for you. Let me help you. Because it's so, you know, that's like a moment where you realize that when we talk about access to justice.
Yeah.
It's not some, you know, lawyer's thing that they talk about at conferences. It's actually a real thing that in as much as these laws are written for you to exercise and enforce your right, there's just so much. Even lawyers sometimes get it wrong.
Yeah.
It's, it's the issue of access to justice is a real one.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what the answer is, but it's you know, sometimes one does wish that one could get advice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one does wish that one had a time to give to advise all the people that need to be advised. And part of the reason why I love this JOB here at Kai FM is because I get to talk to people and share some of the knowledge that I've gained over the years. So yeah. Anyway,
it has happened to me before when you're in the High Court and someone is just about to lose their property, and they're unrepresented, particularly these repossessions of property. And it has happened to me before where I stood up and say, you know what, stand this matter down. Let me go see if
I've done it before.
I've done it.
I wanted to do it today. But you know, the other fear is that if he started, you have to see it through.
Yeah.
Right? It could take 2 years. Just like marry the guy. All right, so people do respond.
Yeah.
People do respond. Tommy responded. Hello, Tommy. Good evening to you, and thank you very much for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. My topic is completely unrelated to what you're discussing.
The commission stuff was really boring.
No, it's not. My problem relates to a cell phone network.
Yeah.
I simply committed fraud with my ID, and I've been running after one of these providers in order to them to sort out the fraud investigation relating to my query.
Yeah.
I'm at the point now where no one will take my call, no one will answer, mm-hmm. no one will respond. I've gone to the police station.
Mm-hmm.
I think I need to go find legal advice,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not exactly sure what my next step should be, because basically I'm getting money deducted every month for something that I'm not using, and nobody's going to reimburse me all the money that's been given, that's been taken from me.
Okay.
And I can't put a debit stop order on it because it will affect my credit profile. So I'm really stuck in a hard place right now.
Sorry, what do you mean you can't put?
Yeah.
So the last part.
I can't put a stop order
mm-hmm.
on my credit profile at the bank.
Why not?
To stop them taking the money.
Why not?
Because it will reflect negatively on my credit report.
Who said that?
As saying that I'm a bad payer.
No, no, no.
That's the payment not true. Is not due.
Payment is not due. If I knew, I would deduct money off your account because I know you won't stop it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it just means you could just be had.
Yeah.
Gratuitously. So, Tommy, there's no, it's not true that if you tell the bank to stop allowing somebody to deduct money from your account, it affects your credit record. Not at all.
And in fact, even that money that has already been deducted, you're entitled to receive it back.
Correct.
If you say you didn't enter into a contract with that service provider.
Did you not enter into a contract, or did you?
I do have a contract with the provider, but it's a partial contract, not for an entirely two new whole cell phones. Mine is for a data contract.
Well,
they've already got my details based on my initial contract.
All right, let me understand. Okay, now I understand. So it's not a fraud issue.
It is a fraud issue, but I've also got my own existing contract with the provider.
Okay, so sorry, these two lawyers are very slow, maybe one more than the other. I'm not pointing fingers. So you have, let's say the cell phone provider is A, right? You have a contract with A.
Yes.
But and then A is supposed, in terms of the contract, supposed to deduct 200 rands from you.
Yes.
But what A does is that they take that 200 rands and go ahead and take another 250 that you don't know why. Is that it?
No, it's more like 2,000 rand more.
All right. The number doesn't matter. Mm. But are they deducting twice or
no,
once?
No, they are deducting for additional contracts that was taken out fraudulently.
On your ID?
On my ID.
Okay. All right. So what you do is you tell the you go to the bank, because it's still the same point.
Mm.
You go to the bank and then you say stop this payment, and then you go to cell phone provider A and you say, cell phone provider A, you I've been telling you repeatedly, and I hope you've been keeping some kind of record, that you are taking more than what I've contracted for. So I've stopped the debit order, and I'm now going to pay you in cash, and I'm going to you know, you must tell me how much I owe you and I will come and I'll deposit that money into your account. And if your bank says, which they may very well do, they might say, but you did sign with, you know, in respect of portion, yes, this amount.
Yes.
You'll say...
The problem is, the reason why I'm afraid to go to the bank, it's going to be more of an inconvenience for me. Because in my whole... What if they then freeze my account because I'm saying that there's fraud happening here?
Wait, like, when did you go so far?
Stop my existing account. No, I've had such bad luck lately that I'm afraid of things like that happening to
okay.
me.
Okay, so let's do this, right? So I know there's bad luck, and you probably have legitimate reasons for feeling that way. I'm saying that they won't freeze your account because you stopped somebody on the basis that you don't have a contract with them. It's not if somebody has defrauded the cell phone provider, it's none of your business. Okay? If they think it's you,
business, no, they're using me.
I got it.
And I don't want to be used like this.
I think the answer is as follows. The amount that you are due to pay in terms of your contract, pay it. The amount over and above that which you are saying is as a result of a fraudulent contract, you are entitled to stop that payment. Not only are you entitled to stop that payment from your bank by telling your bank not to pay it, you are equally entitled to go to the service provider and recover those amounts because those amounts are not due.
Yeah, but the service provider is not listening to me. They're not responding to me.
Well, it depends on how much the total amount would be. Then you're entitled to approach any court. If the amount is less than 15,000, which is the total amount that they have taken, you can go to the small claims court or you can invoke provisions in the Consumer Protection Act.
You got lots of options, Tami. So it's not going to affect your credit record and they're not going to freeze your account. It's very drastic measures that they can't take. Let's go to Nomvula from Johannesburg.
Hi, good evening to you, gentlemen in the studio. I have a question, and I'm asking this on behalf of my sister, who was divorced by her partner 7 to 8 years ago.
How many?
And she did not get anything from that that marriage or whatever that marriage. They were married in community of property. She didn't get anything basically.
How many years ago did you say this was?
7 to 8 years.
Okay. What was it?
Why is there an expectation that she should have gotten something?
They were married in community of property. So the husband took an early pension, so she did not benefit from that from the pension.
Well, look,
is that correct?
The reason I'm asking is that the assumption in your question is that the joint estate was solvent. In other words, at the point at which they were getting divorced, they had excess money over and above the debts which the joint estate had because they were married in community of property. And you are suggesting, your question assumes that they did not have any debts which needed to be satisfied by the joint estate and that she should have been entitled to an amount after the debts have been paid. And do you know, as a matter of fact, that that joint estate was solvent?
I'm not 100%, but she thought that because they were married in community property, she had to get half of the pension.
But she for all intents and purposes, she is entitled to it. She's entitled to half, but she's also obliged to pay half of the debt.
Yeah.
In fact, before she even becomes entitled to half, like Mlilo said, is that the estate first has to pay other people, and then what remains after the debts have been satisfied is then subject to sharing. Now, the problem that you know, you and it would have been nice, and your sister's welcome to phone us directly, but the issue is always, why did you wait 8 years, you know? Because 8 years down the line, things are a little bit, you know, confused now. Whereas when you're fresh out of a divorce, then you are able to then say, because if you are divorced, the divorce decree can't ignore the question of the estate. So a divorce decree can't just say you are divorced full stop. It says you are divorced. If you married in community of property, it has to deal with the division of the joint estate. If you've got children, it has to deal with the dealings as regards the children. So for us to be able to help you in a meaningful way, we would have to get that information.
Okay.
All right. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to take your call, Lungile, we're going to take your call, Hebron, and we're going to take your call, Afropolitan, if you give us a ring, 086-000-0959.
The Law Report on Kaya FM 95.9.
Welcome back. I'm with Mlilo. Yeah. Mlilo Advocate. All right. Let's go back to the lines. Lungile, good evening.
Mike, Mlilo.
Sure. We're very good, very good. How are you?
Good, man, good.
Sorry, awesome.
Take the conversation backwards, but I just want to touch on a very, very important point that the gentleman made at the beginning when you started discussing the issue around the Bonzo Commission.
Yeah.
I've been one of the people who have been screaming at the top of my lungs to say that the very first, I think, misstep when this commission was put together was the, let's call it what it was the superseding of the executive authority of the president with that of the judiciary. In my eyes, I'm no fan of the former president, but that in itself kind of, you know, took off the veil of legitimacy with regard to the commission and the commission's work. Because, as you said, it set a very bad precedent. Now, one can understand that in the political landscape, that was an unprecedented time. And therefore, some may argue that that was a necessary step to ensure that, in fact, there is some form of legitimacy to the entire process. However, you can see now that the main protagonists have been using those decisions and a number of other decisions taken by the judiciary to kind of constantly bash and try to undermine the legitimacy of the commission. And that, like you guys say, its genesis stems exactly from that very act. And ever since then, I feel like it's been downhill. One can just look at the utterances that were made by the deputy SG of the ANC in the last couple of weeks, where, you know, I think a comment was made to the effect that whenever they go to the North Gauteng airport, they can already, you know, kind of have an order.
Know how it's going to go.
Yeah. So when people speak about a crisis within the judiciary, some of these things that have happened, some of the decisions that have been made, they give credence to that type of argument. Whether or not they hold water, that's another issue altogether. But I feel like serious steps have been taken with regard to reform the commission. The commission itself now is suffering from an identity of illegitimacy. It's suffering from a lack of authority. One can only wonder what will happen once the report actually comes out. I would even go as far as to assume that it will probably be part of the toilet literature in Parliament. I think serious steps have been made, and the judiciary has to begin, like, raise its hand and take some blame for some of the things that have been happening lately. And I think it's about time that, you know, we kind of rip off the sanctity with regard to the supreme powers of the judiciary and start to question some of these things, because that, in my view, was a subversion of a constitutional power. If we give the court the right to subvert constitutional powers of the executive authority, where do we start to draw the line in terms of the three pillars of the state? Are we moving towards a judicial democracy where the judiciary rules with a kind of a or rather an oversight over the executive powers? Are we saying that we're moving towards a point where the courts will, in essence, would be where the democratic power lies? So those are
some
of the issues that I wanted to mention.
Look, the point that you raise about you know, the constitutional powers and the subversion, I mean, that's undeniable. And I think that there's another problem about this whole sort of scenario. If a decision is made that a chief justice is to appoint somebody who's to head a commission, when that chief justice accedes to that finding or that recommendation, and you are aggrieved by that decision, where do you go?
Yeah,
exactly.
Where do you go to say, I don't like the decision of the Chief Justice?
Yeah.
And, you know, so the review of all of these things, so why did you agree? It's a bit of a crisis. Where I do part with you, Lungile, is I don't think that the issues pertaining to the commission are to be found where you and Lilo point to. In other words, its formation and constitution. I think that the problem lies in the very fact that the commission was a nonsensical idea in the first place, right? And nonsensical from a legal point, but from a political point of great advantage. And when you read, so for example, the reason why there was a Colosseum was just to entertain the masses, right?
Sure.
And then the reason why, you know, when the U.S. led, when the U.S. invaded Iraq, what they did is that they put journalists and embedded them into the military and put them in the front line so that they can record and report on the day-to-day victories and the army's welfare and all of those things. And then that diverted the attention of the American public and indeed the world from the logic and rationale for the war and more into the day-to-day activities of the war and the small little victories and the fact that people were missing their families and that the military was well-fed and well-trained. The attention was diverted away. And what's happening here, it's exactly the same thing. Because you are sitting, instead of watching the prosecution of people, you are sitting and watching them pretty much make fools of us, right? And associate, you know, a cough to the request, you know, a sore throat. I mean, the association between a sore throat and the lift on somebody's private jet, I'm baffled to find it. But my bafflement is of no consequence because it's just entertainment. And the entertainment comes in the bafflement of me, not in the real issue. So what's happening now is that we're getting these day-to-day blows that keep us entertained and baffled. And nobody's really concerned with the real questions. And nobody's really concerned about the real. If you look at the reporting, our attention is drawn to these little entertainments. And they've been hugely entertaining. But certainly don't solve a problem.
100%. I agree with you 100%. I mean, the most we're getting out of the commission are very entertaining sound bites. All you have to look at is the past few days when the former minister's wife was testifying at the commission.
Yeah, and what we need. Sorry, Lila. You know, I want to move on. But what we need is we're fine with entertainment. We're good. What we need is arrests, resignations, and accountability.
Yep. But Mike, so people come and give evidence in silos.
Yes.
You come and say what you want to say. You go home. The other one comes and say what he wants to go. Where there's a dispute of fact. What method is Deputy Chief Justice going to use to resolve the dispute?
So you know what's going to happen to that report?
Yeah.
We're going to talk about it for 2 weeks and be super entertained.
Yeah.
And then we're going to move on. They're going to make new news for us. They're going to give us new news, tell us what to concern ourselves. Lungile, thank you very much for your call. I really, really appreciate, man. We're going to go to Andrew from Johannesburg. Andrew?
I'm from Carltonville. Eh?
Andrew, are you from Carltonville?
Yeah.
All right. I'm sorry.
Yeah, my old matter is I'm having a divorce case.
Yeah,
which I've opened on. I mean, in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So currently, what happened is, I was in Pretoria. My family is in Pretoria,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm partially blind. Né?
Mm-hmm.
So my contract was ended in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So after all, I got an amount of about 793,000 rand, which of which I told my wife, look, we need to get a house. We don't have a house.
You told who?
My wife.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then I said to her, look, you know my situation, so go and look around for a house. Then I said to her, look, I can be able to contribute about 654, a better house.
Mm.
So we took 650 to Remax for a deposit. It was in Pretoria. But at the end of the day, what she did, she went to SA Home Loan to top up the amount, because her desired house was about 1.085 million. Then she came back to me and said, no, I found a house of 1.085 million, but how are you going to afford it? She said, no, I'm going to be able to pay it. Then after going to transfer legal costs, we were with a younger sister, which she was staying with us. And I said to her, look, I don't understand, why is she going with us? She said, no, she's going to stand as a witness. Getting there, we didn't even get the details of the signing. We were just given papers.
Yeah.
Only to find that, okay, things turned out not to be okay in the house. Then I decided to come back home. And then I went to one of the lawyers around here. And going on, he discovered that there's a third person in the house. And I said,
there's a what?
He said to me, the third person in the house.
Yeah.
He said to me, who's this other person? I said, no, that's a younger sister. She is a witness. She was actually paying for, she told me that she's going to pay rates and services.
Yeah.
Because it's an estate house. Then he said to me, no, this is not a witness. This is the joint owner. You are three in the house. And then, okay, he said to me, we're going to a pre-trial. And I couldn't understand why were we supposed to be three. He said, no, you cannot dispute it because it's written there.
You can dispute it.
Yeah, you can.
You are blind. So you are accompanied by your wife, and then okay, nyamutwa wakwabo.
Yes, no. The whole thing is all about. I had to cancel the pre-trial because.
Yeah, just help me quickly. When did all of this happen?
You know, signing of the house.
Yeah.
It was in Pretoria.
When, Ning?
We bought the house in 2015.
When did you find out about the sister?
Just in 2019, because I had to come and open the case here in Carlton Village. So
you've opened a case of fraud?
No, it's a divorce case.
Okay.
But I didn't go and open for a fraud case.
You should.
Oh, I should go there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this is upsetting.
Where should I go?
To the police station.
Okay. Now the whole thing about it, man, my lawyer said to me, look, for me to go for a trial now, you need to pay me about 45,000 rand. So that we can go for a trial. But I said, look, you know, that was not an agreement. You know that I'm not working. I'm just a SASSA recipient, ne? Yeah. I said to me, no, I need to pay my workers and other things. I have to do other things about the money.
Is the trial for what?
The divorce.
No, for a divorce. So
what I'm trying to establish is in the divorce, what is the issue that is in contentious that requires a trial?
Do you have children?
The house was there because, okay, she said to me she'll give me half of her pension. And then we talked about the assets, and then the house is going to stay as three as it is. We are thinking it. And then she will be able to share about 0.33% of the house, which is three of us.
Yeah.
And then one of the things that I didn't understand is that the lawyer made an internet evaluation of the house, which was, 1.085 in 2015.
Yeah.
Last year, he told me that he found out that it's about 1.120 million. I said, no, but it can be. It appreciates.
So, can I ask you a question? You said that you gave her 750. Did the sister contribute anything to the house?
650.
She contributed.
She contributed 470.
The sister.
I'm not sure about the sister. How much did she did? Because she told me after getting that, she said, "No, I found the loan." I said, "Okay." But now I couldn't know because I didn't know even if my sister was included into that. That is why I'm not even sure how much she contributed.
Okay, you need to find somebody you trust. You need that person to sort of look at documents that you have, because I'm going to tell you to open a fraud case. Meanwhile, I don't know if the sister contributed, and you know what I mean. It wouldn't be fraud. Yeah. So it would be fraud if if the sister is just put in there and she's getting nice benefits, but she didn't put in anything. But if, okay. if you're not able to afford the lawyer that you currently have, because, you know, it's not the lawyer's fault that he wants to charge and he needs a fee for his services. It just means that you probably are not the right match for each other. So you either find a lawyer that you can afford, or you find a lawyer that is able to help you free of charge. And there are plenty of law clinics that having regard to your disability as well would be more inclined to help, because I think you would provide special circumstances. Okay.
Okay.
So right. Do that. But the story is a little bit everywhere, in a sense that you know this and you don't know that, right? You don't know how you gave 750. Your house is 1080. You don't know how the difference was funded. Because there's also a loan. Is that loan mortgaged against your house? There's a lot of questions.
I want to ask that. And in the final analysis, what exactly do you want?
Good question.
Is it what exactly do you want as a result? Outcome do you want?
I need to find out how did you manage to be free in the house. And after all, I think another day you need to resolve it to such an extent that I get satisfied to the fact that if you are free, then why couldn't the lawyers actually tell us that you are free in the house?
So you need to go back to those lawyers, but go with somebody you trust. And it's very easy. If a convincing attorney puts three people, he or she wouldn't have an interest. Convinces, they wouldn't be colluding with these people, trust me. They would have been told whatever and they registered in three people's names. So you need to go back to them. They will happily assist you, I promise you. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Hang on. So when you go to the very conveyances that transferred your property, take somebody else to help you go through documents or however you read.
Okay.
And those conveyances will tell you exactly why there's three of you. And then if you find out that the sister just brought herself and didn't contribute anything financially, then you potentially have a fraud case, but I can't confirm because your case is a little bit straightforward. Well, I mean, not so straightforward, yeah.
I think what might have happened, I mean, I'm guessing, of course, is that, I mean, both the wife and the husband are there because they would have required the consent of the other party in the acquisition of the property. So the conveyancers would have seen both of them and perhaps been told that, no, this is a reflection of the consent. That
correct. This is my husband. It's the three of us. So, but they will tell you because a conveyancer is nobody's lawyer. That's a nice thing. You know, like if you ask a conveyancer what happened here, they'll happily provide you that information. There isn't sort of a confidentiality thing where they can't help you. I promise you, they will help you. I'm going to take a break, and when I come back, I'm taking more of your calls.
The Law Report on Kaya FM 95.9.
Welcome back to The Law Report. I'm in conversation with Ngobisi Tamlilo, and we're talking about whatever you want us to talk about. 086-000-00959. Thabo from Johannesburg. Good evening.
Good evening, sir. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Good evening to your guest also. As much as I would love to get into the commission issue, guys, there's something very close to my heart that happened with my mother-in-law. So what happened is that there was fraud on her bank account recently at about mid-March.
Sure.
So for an amount of 12,000 or so.
Yeah.
And the bank refused to take liability. So I took it upon myself because having experience with working in a fraud department in a different bank, I tried to help him. So what's baffling me with the case is that, number one, the bank refused to take liability, even though I could see from whatever they gave us that my mother was not liable. The bank refused to even give us the logs for whatever transaction that they claim happened and my mother is liable for. And when I went on to further investigate myself, I found that the bank didn't even follow up with the merchant as to whether the goods were released or not.
Yeah.
Now, the merchant obviously has released the deed to the fraudster and the merchant is a third party. There's nothing wrong with that procedure. Now, my biggest question is that how does a bank now let a transaction occur on any account if it says, for example, OTP expired? Because the OTP is a security feature they put in place to protect the consumer.
Mm.
Now, if that security measure passes and it tells the bank that this is not supposed to go through as a valid transaction, but the bank allows the transaction to go off and even goes as far as to deny liability and say the customer is liable when they have an information like that in front of them. How do you now deal with such a matter? And even when you take the matter to an ombudsman and present the fact...
Did you go to the ombudsman?
The matter is sitting with the ombudsman now. The ombudsman has given the bank another opportunity to respond.
Yeah.
They have not...
Yeah, because that's where I was going to send you and from Lilo's body language.
Yeah, and remember, the basic principle of banking is that the bank pays whoever you want to be paid on demand, and they can only take an instruction from you to effect payment to someone.
Mm.
So you have to be able to demonstrate that the payment that was done to that merchant was not on the instruction of your mother-in-law.
And that's it.
It's just as simple as that.
Yeah, and you know, the only manner in which banks are able to get away with it, or at least escape liability, is if they show your own culpability. So if they say, we've put a measure of security and we've put an OTP and you shared the OTP with somebody, then you got a bit of a problem. Or we gave you a card and you shared your card with some, then you are culpable. You've played some kind of a role. But if you're sitting in your own space quietly and some things are happening, that's on the bank, because it's the bank's systems. They it's their system. So I'm very hopeful, and I would really like it very much if you did call us at some point. But I'm very hopeful that the ombud should be able to help you, because what might have happened, I suspect, is that it was easy for the bank to say no to your mom-in-law, but it's not going to, once they know that it's before the ombudsman, it probably also just cost them a lot more money
than 12,000.
You know, for them to send representatives and debate and argue about 12 grand as opposed to just paying it. So I think it'll go well, brother.
Okay, because they even offered to, once we launched the complaint, they even offered to pay about 3,400.
Nah, nah, about 12.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's what you said.
All right. Don't worry.
No, you'll be fine.
Give it time.
Yeah.
And phone us if it doesn't go that way. Hebron.
Good evening, Mr. Mutsuri, to you and your colleague and the KFM listeners there.
How that was all we say, how not.
He wants your job, Mike.
He was ready. He was like, yeah, now give it to me. 3, 2. Yes, yeah, my turn. Yeah.
He's racing, man. He's doing auditions. Yeah. He's auditioning.
I currently now, I was brought up Catholic, for it. That's why I get about
intimate. No wonder I was pretending to be sleeping. You wanted this time.
All right, how do we help you, brother?
Let me just get straight into it and talk about one of the prevalent issues that I think the legal fraternity in the country is currently overlooking. And this is with respect to the 350 social relief fund that is unpaid to the applicants or either the recipients of this social relief fund. The question that I actually have to you is to ask, what is the legal recourse for people that have been unpaid by the Department of Social Development? Yeah, that's it. That's my question. I think even from an entrepreneurial perspective, as an advocate, or as somebody who is actually trying to enter into the law fraternity, you can actually find this as an opportunity for you to earn yourself a living.
He's referring to the 300, the social grant.
Which one? Because there's quite a lot of schemes. Yeah. There's one for musicians, which in and of themselves were quite controversial. There's one for normal employees that was part of like the UIF payment. And then there's grants.
Yeah.
The 350 rand.
Is the grant one.
Yeah. Which one are you referring to, Hebron?
I'm referring to the one that is being facilitated by the Department of Social Development.
For the 350 rand?
Yeah, the 350 rand.
Okay. And the question is, what do you do if you applied and you didn't get it?
That's right. Especially for maybe a period of 12 months or more than that.
Sure.
Or even less.
No, yeah.
No, the answer is there in the constitution. It's a straightforward answer, a constitutional answer. The constitution gives the right to, the constitution gives an obligation on the state to provide social amenities and to provide social protection in situations of distress as a constitutional right. Mm. So to the extent someone can demonstrate that they meet the criteria that the state has set out, to be cushioned, then there's a clear constitutional point to make that you're entitled to the payment.
But isn't that rider that went along the lines of
progressive realization?
Yes.
Yeah, it's progressive realization. Remember what progressive realization says. Once you have already made the commitment, you must pay it.
Yeah. Sure.
So the progressive super money and
so you're saying you have a right to housing, so we'll provide housing. But if you say we are going to give all of you houses this year,
yes,
because they when they came out with 350 and the budget, they had made allocations. Obviously, it would have had to have been scientific need versus budget.
Yes.
Ah.
So it has already created what is called a core minimum obligation. A core minimum obligation that says you have already committed to 350, so pay it.
Yes.
Next time you can't pay 310 because you've already created a core minimum obligation that is at 350. Mm. So the progressive realization means that you have already set a basis upon which the minimum payment would be made. The next payment has to be progressively more than the previous payment. So the answer to your question is that there is a constitutional right to social protection in times of distress. The state recognized that obligation and made an undertaking to pay the 350 rands. Once you meet the obligation, once you meet the criteria the state has set out, a right has been triggered that forces the state to pay that amount. And we are no longer talking about progressive realization because the state has already said we'll pay you this. Mm. It's different to what happened in Subramani where you say, I want a dialysis. Then they say, no, but we don't have the dialysis. We only have 10. Mm. So we are going to progressively make these dialysis more. Once they are there, the obligation has now been triggered.
Okay. And vaccines, when are we getting those ones?
Hey, that's they are suing them left, right, and center in Europe.
Mr. Busiri.
Dad.
You know what? Here's the general consensus that I actually get from the people that are actually on the ground. Because, you know, I've just been working on one particular case as well in relation to the same matter. And the general consensus that I get is that even when they have made an appeal to say that I have made a submission on all the platforms that have actually been recommended by the Department of Social Development to say this is how you actually apply for this particular type of grant, but over the last 12 months, the department has actually failed to pay out that total amount that is the prescribed 350 social relief fund per month, right? So now my concern is, if you have tried all those particular avenues, and still you are not getting the response that is due to you, and that is satisfactory to you as an applicant, what would be the starting point for you to challenge the department?
You know, the tragedy. I mean, the tragedy about life is that it's easy for somebody to do this, against a would-be grant recipient, because what do you do? Mm. You know, what do you do for 350? If you bring 1,000 people that want
to,
you know, so if you organize and you get 1,000 people that each want their 350, you'll probably have a lot more people that can help you. But when you are, you know, like there's a saying, united We are strong.
Yeah.
So if you are coming and you got your little problem, 350, and it's all isolated. So if you really want to help this group of people, help them organize. And once you've organized, you can bring a nice application.
A class action.
And it would be very nice. I would love for it to happen because then next time we make promises to the people, we will make sure that we've thought about our budget and our affordability and our mechanisms to deliver the money to the people.
Or even Mike, to do it, take five or so people, bring an application to court, get an order that is a structural order that says...
Right.
Yeah.
Right, like Section 20.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Mpo?
Hi, Mike. Hi. I need to ask you something. If my sister sold a house without divulging that I'm also present as a sister, we are born from the same mother, and our father died, and we were the only two left, and she manages to sell the house. And when I once we see the advert, I then went to the Masters of the High Court to say this is the situation, and they wrote us a letter that we must take with to the police station to have it served to my sister, and the gates were always locked. We didn't have any access until the house got registered. What recourse do we have for the matter to be, auto for the house to be reversed and be in our mother's name?
Is your mother alive?
No, they died.
The house was registered in your mother's name.
Yes.
And then she passed on. What happened to the winding down of her estate?
That's what I need to know, because I was never made aware. The only time I was aware is when I saw that the house was being advertised on private property.
So the property wouldn't have been able, or it's not possible to transfer the property before the final winding down of her estate.
This one created fraud.
Yeah. So,
okay.
So what I did is I obtained the title deed of the buyer. And I managed to make an appointment with the conveyancing attorney. So in attempt for the matter to be made null and void, because not all parties were notified, and nobody nominated the sister to be the executor of the estate.
Yes.
So who is the current executor?
Self-nominated sister.
Yes, of course. That's how you do fraud. So the master must now do its job. Because when you nominate, when you lodge a deceased estate, there are things that in there that you say, you have to say on affidavit. You have to say there's a next of kin affidavit. And in the next of kin affidavit, you got to declare who are the kins of the deceased.
Ah, okay.
And if you are not declared as a kin, and she goes on and she does all of these nice things, you're going to have a very difficult case trying to claim the property back. But you can have a very easy case sending her to jail, which is probably where she belongs.
Unless
she's able to pay you.
I think rather started the master,
and
notify the master about it. Then,
absolutely, you're dead right. The master should have the master has and you know its own mechanisms of saying what do I do when declarations are made to me as the master, because I issued this letter of authority or the letter of executive on the strength of the information that you've given me. Now that it comes to light that this information is untrue, what do I do as the master? Okay. And they have to come in. All right?
Okay.
But all bother them. Bother them. Go there every day.
Yeah, no, they don't have a chance, because even my aunt did the same. And we approached a lawyer and the matter was reversed.
Yeah, but you see, it's not easy to reverse it. If somebody says, you know, I bought this thing, who's going to give me my money? Yeah. Right? So reversal is not very easy. What is easy is if at the threat of the police, your sister might sort of put some money together and make good with you. Okay? But it's really sad. It's really sad. I think Sechaba Saranso, sometimes some part. How do you do this? How do you go chow money, like go buy KFC and eat it and knowing that you've cheated somebody? I can't get how somebody would live off somebody else's tears. I just can't get it.
Well, people do
this. Are you sure you're not a pastor?
You know, like the older I grow up, I'm like, guys. Anyway, that's the whole report. Nilo?
Thank you very much, Mike. Yeah. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Afropolitan. Good night.
The Law Report with Michael Motsoeneng Bill on Kaya FM 95.9. Kaya FM Podcast. Go to kayafm.co.za for more.